Welcome onliners too. So welcome those in the Gompa. I love this course because these Buddhist essentials, ethics, concentration and wisdom, they're really important for everything. And we can kind of pick them up a little bit in life just through reading or hearing about things, but they are things that we need training in. And I was thinking, it's just like with driving. You might pick up driving. You might be able to get into the driver's seat when you're a teenager and your kids let you get in the seat early and you kind of pick it up, and you picked it up because you watched your parents drive. And that might do. It might be okay until you find yourself in a difficult situation. So until you get bogged, or until you get stuck in the desert or on a mountain pass in Nepal and you get terrified that you're going to go over the edge, or until you have to drive a huge, great big truck, then you need training. So these three Buddhist essentials are like the training that we need so that we have all the skills to get to enlightenment. And we do them all a little bit already. And so this just means that we, just like with driving, we become a really good defensive driver. And so we become much more confident. Our path becomes much clearer. Sometimes when I lead this course, I go backwards. We do wisdom, then concentration, then ethics, because the path to liberation is the wisdom realizing emptiness, cutting the self-grasping ignorance. And this is the only way to remove the seeds of suffering, our constant readiness for problems and misery. Attaining this wisdom depends on single-pointed concentration. That's what we're looking at tonight. And single-pointed concentration depends on pure ethical conduct. So the three higher trainings, ethics, concentration, wisdom, higher, because their aim is much more than just a good life. It's actually to be able to stop this whole cycle, the ups and downs of a samsaric lifestyle. It's all okay when things are going well, but the moment things go a bit pear-shaped, the moment something happens either to us or to our environment, then we really find ourselves flailing about and wishing that we had better skills in all of these three. So the goal, liberation, enlightenment, and then of course we get everything that goes along the way. Our own day-to-day life becomes better. But if we don't have the really big goal of liberation or enlightenment and just have the goal just to get through this particular current problem, what happens when the particular current problem is over, is fixed? We stop all of our work. We stop developing in that way. If anyone's ever tried to develop a meditation practice, does anyone here meditate every day, by the way, or not? You can be honest. I don't. Snippets? Yep. Yeah. Yeah, for some years I was really disciplined. I had a daily meditation practice every day. And then other years, yeah, it's just snippets like that. And so now I've got a meditation practice that's, I say my prayers, but I don't really count it as a meditation practice. I just keep my commitments. But the actual focusing, the meditation, yeah, that definitely comes and goes. And it's kind of hard. So I think, so why do we fall off the wagon? Why do we have a meditation practice for a while, get all enthused, like a New Year's resolution, and then fall off the wagon? And usually it's because our goal isn't big enough. It's a really small goal. And usually our goal is we just want to deal with our stress. And if that's our sole purpose for meditating, just dealing with stress, once our stress is alleviated, we'll stop meditating. So with all of these three, with training in all these three, then we cut the root of suffering forever. So let's do a short meditation to set our motivation, focus our mind, adjusting our posture, and then adjusting our mind. So with the posture, really simple, straightening your spine, sitting well back in the chair so that your lower back is supported. And then putting a little bit of effort into keeping the top part of your torso straight so that you're feeling alert. Imagine a thread of light running from the base of your spine up through your body, out through your crown, and that you're just being gently pulled upwards from your crown. So you might notice that you sit back a little bit more. But also your head should just tilt forward slightly, tuck the chin in. And every time that you breathe in, let your posture become a little bit more straight and alert. Every time you breathe out, release any tension from the neck and shoulders. Make sure that your shoulders are pulled back a little bit so the whole chest and heart area is open. And relax the jaw, put a slight smile on your lips. Have the tongue on the upper palate behind the top teeth. Release any tension from the eyes and let your eyes just be lightly closed or a little sliver of light coming in. And even though there is the busy world going on around us, bring your focus inwards. Just become aware of the breath and the natural rhythm of your breathing. So just as you're breathing, you can say in and out on each breath, just to gently anchor your attention there, just onto the breath. And everything else can still be in the periphery, but you're just not focusing on it. And just leave it there on the outskirts of your attention and have your attention just gently resting on the breath as it rises and falls. And as you're focusing on the breath, you might find that you get distracted by external information coming in through the senses, sounds or sensations. Or you might get distracted by internal thoughts or feelings or memories. So whenever they arise, that's natural. But try and notice as soon as possible without getting involved, and then just name them, thought or feeling, sensation. Let them go and bring your focus back to the breath. So notice a name and then bring your attention to the breath. And gradually, as your distractions begin to settle, just like autumn leaves begin to settle once the wind has stopped, then we can adjust our motivation for tonight, making sure it's a really broad and meaningful motivation. So start by whatever brought you here, why you're here tonight. Could be doing many other things, but there was something that brought you here specifically tonight. So bring that to mind. And then think of the benefit that you hope to receive. Then think of how in turn that benefit can expand. You yourself can become a calmer, kinder person. Those around you can receive help, kindness. How your whole community can benefit. How we can continue our inner spiritual journey. And how the very end point of that spiritual journey is nothing less than liberation from cyclic existence and full enlightenment for the benefit of all. So we can even set our goal that far and then receive everything in between. And so with this vast purpose for our class tonight, then take a deep breath in through your nose, out through your mouth, and gently bring your focus back to the room. So concentration is our topic for tonight, and our quote from Gelug Rinpoche: once we begin the practice of training in concentration, we should continue every day until we reach our goal. If conditions are perfect, we can do this in as little as 3 months or so. So the goal is single-pointed concentration, and not just for a second, but for as long as we like, on whatever object we like, in whatever manner we like. So you can tell if you've actually attained single-pointed concentration if you can focus in a relaxed, clear way on your object of concentration for 4 hours without any distraction. And then you've fully accomplished it if you can do this for hours or days or years. But your first initial thing is 4 hours. That's the benchmark that we're aiming at. So, you know, we just did this little meditation just now to set our motivation. How's our core skills going? Are we match fit for our meditation? Because it's just like an athlete trains externally, then we train our mind internally. So, I mean, we've got some form of concentration because we're not running screaming from the room, which, like, if we're a toddler, we would have done that by now. So we have progressed in our life. But, you know, in terms of how our concentration is, how do you reckon it is? How do you feel? How do you feel about it? Seconds?
Yeah.
Well, seconds is okay. Seconds is on the path. You know, it's the first stage of concentration. Possibly the second stage of concentration. See, I can't even remember now, but in those stages of meditation, just having the intention is the first stage, then being able to hold it for just a second. We're already getting somewhere. A few seconds, good. What else? Yes, so what is it about the Sunday meditations that makes it easier?
Well, it depends
easier.
On the person's voice.
Uh-huh, their voice.
Somewhere that the voice just sort of
guides you and it's paced well and yeah. Yeah, and also I think because there's a familiarity there, so you're not going, oh my gosh, what's happening? You already know, so you're in the flow, and that familiarity is part of the whole process. Plus, we're in a holy place, so that helps. That's like the blessings of the Buddhas right there. Plus, meditating in a group is so much easier. It's like you get the energy of the group, that you put a little bit of effort in and your mind can focus. Whereas if you're at home, you need a big effort. Right, so you can't see through the window, so you don't have what's happening over there.
Squirrel.
Yes. Yeah, so when they say having a really vast view, that's right, a spacious view, not like, what are the neighbours doing for you? Yeah, so you can really only hold one thing in mind at a time. So what's happening with our senses when we're being distracted is we're jumping around like a monkey from one thing to another thing. And it's called attention capture. And that's how come like ads and video games and everything gets our attention, because it continuously grabs it again and again and again. So we can think, oh, I've been focused on this game for hours, but actually it's our attention's being captured for hours and hours and hours. So the moment you try and actually put your attention onto something without it being pulled off by something else, then we go, oh my gosh, now just a few seconds, you know, it takes effort. Yeah. And so actually single point of concentration, then you are not aware of what's around you. Your focus isn't distracted or captured like that. That's for focusing one pointedly on an object. But there is also another type of concentration that is broad awareness, that is aware of the space in which everything arises. But again, you're not focused on any one particular thing. You're aware of the spaciousness. Yeah. What's happening for the rest of the day, and you've got plans and everything. Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah, so often the times for doing our meditation, they say, of course, the morning is the best because you're fresh and you haven't got into the busyness of the day. And it's there's something to be said for your mind being being fresh like that. That said, if you're waking up and dragging yourself out of bed exhausted, it's not going to work. If you're not a morning person, you haven't actually had rest. If you've got a whole lot of pressures on and you're just thinking, oh my gosh, what am I going to do for the rest of the day? So it's a different kind of concentration. But that first freshness to something is a really different thing from at night being able to settle into something. It's a different quality of concentration. And I've found myself at night being able to settle into something, it's a lot more with the details. So it's a lot more like an analytical meditation where I can focus on all the details, but the actual freshness of just being with the topic isn't there. That's a morning thing. So, I mean, one of the things also is that just like if we're going to get fit, physically. So has anyone here ever been fit? Yes. Is anyone here fit now? No. Okay. So again, why did you fall off the wagon? What happened?
Food's too tasty.
Food's too tasty. Okay. So that's distraction. Yeah. What else?
Injury.
Huh?
Injury.
Injury. Okay. Yeah. So obstacle, being obstacled, that would be the mental equivalent. And so then you've got to change the whole thing. So you've got a job and you do yoga classes and you've got a job that's got the physical thing, so the activity is built into it.
Yes.
Yes, so, I mean, I relate to all of that. So just like an Olympic athlete, you know, it's possible to really go for it, but you've got to be really disciplined and consistent. So it's great if it's built in, but then, you know, I lost my fitness. I haven't ever had formal fitness training, but I was fit until COVID, and then the lockdowns happened and I lost my physical fitness. So not an injury, but an obstacle. And then getting it back again is really hard. So the consistency, if you have a break, it's really difficult to break it, to build it back up again. And so just like an Olympic athlete, they too, though, go through cycles. They work towards being like match fit, isn't it? So they have cycles when they're having a bit of a rest or a break, and then they have a concerted effort. And I mean, if you have a sporting hero, there's a lot of kind of, there's a lot that we can use to transfer over to Buddhist practice about it. So one of, I mean, I don't know anything about sport and I've avoided sport my whole life. I managed to not go to any sport or PE through my entire 4 years of high school. Like, it's just, however, I'm really into watching the cycling and I absolutely love Pogacar, the cyclist, and I've tried to figure out why. And I think he's got this approach, like he's so dedicated, really consistent, but he loves what he's doing. And he cycles with love, with just incredible joy and generosity, and at the same time with incredible ambition. And there's this combination that we have to also have as meditators of incredible joy and generosity and good-heartedness, and also incredible ambition to get out of samsara and to become enlightened. So we can kind of take that example. We've got it's harder to get that same example with meditators because meditating is such an internal experience. And I just wish that they would have, you know, news, sport, weather, and then the meditators section, like so-and-so has been meditating for 6 hours and they haven't lost their concentration. And, you know, wouldn't it be incredible to have that kind of news report? But of course we wouldn't, because you can't see it. So what actually is concentration? A mental factor that is capable of abiding one-pointedly on an object of virtue without distraction. So this is interesting because, so one-pointedly we kind of understand, but on an object of virtue. So an object of virtue means something that brings happiness and not just distraction, but long-term happiness. So peace of mind. Anything that brings happiness is things like kindness, compassion, wisdom. And it's different from, say, an object of attachment, which, say, might be something that you're looking forward to. It might be something nice, but it's not necessarily an object of virtue, because the anticipation when you get it, you may be disappointed. You may get cranky about that, or all the attachment towards the object means you become possessive. Then means you might become aggressive if people take the object away. So these kind of things, it's not objects of attachment, even though they might be nice to think about. Often later on, our objects of attachment become apparent because our afflictive emotions come up. Also, it's not one-pointed concentration on an object of revenge, which we can have one-pointed concentration on, and many people do, but it's not an object of virtue, so it doesn't result in a peaceful, clear mind. So concentration actually is informed by our ethics. So it's really different, because ordinary concentration, a hitman can have that, a thief can have that. You know, they probably are super concentrated, but what's driving that? What's driving that is usually the afflictions, the afflictive states of mind, of revenge or attachment or hatred. And those are so powerful that your concentration can focus so incredibly intensely. But the result isn't a peaceful, clear mind. The result's completely different. So that's kind of the difference between ordinary concentration and here, high concentration. Higher concentration meaning that the result is mental and physical pliancy. It's naturally blissful. It engenders even more good qualities within us and it benefits others. So these are the results of higher concentration. So mental and physical pliancy means mentally your mind is relaxed and open and clear. And so, I mean, we know how amazing that is when we feel like that, and and things change, our plans change, and we don't stress, we go, oh yeah, right, and we're resilient. You know, just a little taste of that is amazing. So to have that as our whole mode of being, this mental pliancy, and the result of that is we also have physical pliancy, meaning that our body stops aching and that all of our energies flow nicely, so we don't have pain and we don't have sickness, and we, you know, we don't bump into things all the time. So mental and physical pliancy is a result of this one-pointed concentration. It's also a naturally blissful state. It's not naturally flatlining. It's naturally joyous. So it's a state of mind that is joyous, but not distracted. And that might be something quite difficult for us to get our head around, because most of the time, things that are joyous are associated with distractions. But it's kind of, it's a blissfulness that comes from a state of peace. And of course, that state then is the perfect circumstances to develop all of our good qualities, to develop more patience, more kindness, more wisdom. And then of course it naturally benefits others. And so if we have this concentration, even if we don't have single-pointed concentration yet, just even trying to get that means that we'll start experiencing these benefits. And so then we're free from our afflictive states of mind that make us be really reactive, so then we make better decisions in life. And we can figure out what to do and what not to do, so our discrimination becomes better. And so then naturally we feel better about our life. So all the way through, there's incredible benefits. So I think this is another reason why we might fall off the wagon with meditation, or even with getting fit or any of those things, that we forget about the benefits. And this is probably why we get back on again, is that we think, oh, wait, well, like with getting fit, you want to get fit again. You've got a motivator. You want to be healthy, or you want to be strong, or like, I want to be able to go to Ladakh and climb up all the stairs to the monasteries and not pass out when I reach the monastery. So you have a goal, and the goal is something, it's a benefit, it's a good thing. And so you focus on that rather than how difficult it is. The moment we forget our goal and just start thinking about how difficult it is, what's the next thing? Oh, not today. I'm not going today. So the goal is incredibly important to have, and to have this really big, inspiring goal, because that'll keep us on track. So questions, comments, does it make sense? Concentration, how do we develop it? It's a skill. It's a skill that we have to develop. So I will talk a little bit about it as we go through the class. But as we've been going through these three higher trainings, these skills that can lead us to nirvana and enlightenment, they are things we need to train in. So they don't necessarily come naturally. And we may try, I mean, I have a friend who's trying to finish her PhD, and she's got ADHD, so she's, you know, quite naturally distracted. And she's just in torture trying to just focus on finishing her PhD. And it's because what motivates her, well, is all the reasons for doing the PhD, but then the deadline and the pressure of you know, the peer pressure and her all of this. So she's got all of this pressure to motivate her. So then she sits down, she goes, right, I've got to do it. And she sits down and she tries to force herself to do it, but she's got no skills to concentrate. She hasn't actually learned any skills of how to do it. So it's just like she's beating herself up every single day. It's just torture. And we might do that too. We might try and get ourselves in hand and go, right, Miffy, you really got to focus on this now, as if standing over my own shoulder and going to beat myself is going to make me focus. That's not how to do it. There's a skill of how to do it. So we'll get to that, how to get started. Yeah. Yes, to be able to block out all the noise, external noises, but internal noise as well, your mind has to be in a certain frame of mind. Mm-hmm. And so really it comes down to the motivation. Mm-hmm. And most of the time what motivates us is external pressures, deadlines, other people, or we're just so sick of it all. But that's a very poor motivation. So really, if we have this big motivation, an altruistic heart and a confidence that attaining a lasting state of peace of mind is possible, if we have that motivation, then we're willing to really commit. And then as Corey Jackson, who will come and lead some of the Tuesday classes coming up, will say, you have to be relaxed. You can't do it like this. You have to be relaxed. Do we know how to relax? It's one of the things none of us knows how to do in the modern Western world. Absolutely poor at it. And when we do relax, we just relax all the way down and fall asleep because we're so sleep deprived. Isn't it? Is it just like that? So you're right. We have to build this positive frame, that conducive conditions. So part of our concentration that I wanted to bring up that, you know, when there were the COVID lockdowns on, I know none of us wants to think about that time now. It's just like this aberration that didn't happen. But there were some really interesting things that came out of it in terms of concentration. So one of them was that people's memories deteriorated over the time of lockdowns. And it was really interesting, was because we spent all this time indoors, memories are associated with place and happenings. And because we're in the same place over and over and over again, big things might happen, but they were just associated with the same old place. And so the memories couldn't find a base to be laid down. And so we couldn't access them anymore. Our short-term memory as a, you know, just deteriorated incredibly because of that. There's nothing to hook it on. So many of the meditations that we do, the Buddhist meditations, they are activities that we go through of transformation. So there's something to hook it on, to hook our experience on and to recall. Whereas if you've been in lockdown, there was nothing to recall. Or you know how people say, oh, where were you when so-and-so died, when a big event, where were you when the Twin Towers came down? People remember that event by where they were. So how we kind of even remember our world is associated so many with so many external things like that. And so with the internal world, that's why we have these different meditations to hang those experiences on. The other thing that happened was a whole lot of brain fog because our senses, which are constantly drawn outwards, were suddenly deprived. And so we had no external stimulation, and so many people reported having brain fog from just being at home all the time. This also happens when, say, you've got cabin fever. It happens when people are stuck in the Antarctic or whatever in the snowstorms, or when we have a lack of external stimulation. If we are not used to our own company, then we go a little bit crazy. And we either have brain fog or we experience intense distress and our brain starts throwing up all sorts of internal hallucinations just to entertain ourselves. So this kind of showed to me, you know, around that time, it didn't happen to everybody. And of course, so many people associated with Lungri Tungpa Center just went fantastic. Now I have retreat time. I can just go into retreat. And they were just so happy. And while everybody else in the general populace is having a really hard time. So if you have some practice at inner reflection, something like that isn't frightening. But it just showed how generally our culture I mean, not all cultures are like this. Scandinavian countries are not like this. People go out into nature and sit in nature and do nothing, and they're fine. But we're so used to being distracted as a culture. Then there was a third thing that happened with Zoom fatigue. So for you guys on Zoom, that because we are so reliant on our environment to reflect back at us who we are, what's happening, all the different sounds, the movements, the body language, all of those subliminal kind of things, when you're on Zoom, none of that comes through. So you're getting about 5% of normal human communication through this tiny, because, you know, it's just like a tiny little person. And so the effort it takes to communicate is huge. So everyone got Zoom fatigue, you know, because you're just focusing on whatever the one topic is. And if the topic's boring, then it's like it's all over. But at the same time, like, I was just liberated when we came to Zoom because I can't handle all of the people. And also I can't read people's faces. And so I do rely just on words, and that's all you get on Zoom is just words. Unless you have really cartoon huge movements, which I do anyway, and so then they come across as normal on Zoom. So I'm like in my element. I'm the happiest I ever am on Zoom. I mean, it's part of being autistic, this whole thing. And so I just found my element. I was just, yeah, I never thought I would, but I did. It's just such a shame that not everybody feels like that. You're not a big fan? No, hardly anybody is. Yeah. I just, you know, because it just meant that all the periphery and all of the things that I don't understand and get so totally overwhelmed, I'm just free of it. So I just suddenly went, oh, I've got all this energy. While everybody else is just like flailing around and suffering. Okay, so now let's have a look. The obstacles and antidotes to developing this single-pointed concentration or samadhi. And they're really interesting because they're not normally things that you'd think of. So laziness is an interesting one because there's the obvious laziness, which comes from just forgetting the benefits. So it's not that you're a bad person being lazy, but we just go, oh, I'm too tired to do it, because we're not galvanized and excited about it because we haven't really recognized the benefits. So they say that once you actually have a really good meditation experience and get a taste of that calm and peace and clarity, you will be motivated to get back again. And I think it's similar to when you're getting fit. There's the first beginning bits where it's just all pain and tired, and then you get that feeling of being tired but also with energy, and you go, wow, this is great. And so then that overrides the initial reticence. But there's a more subtle form of laziness, which is where we think that we can't do it. So low self-esteem is counted as laziness because we underestimate our potential and we think other people can do it, but there's no way I can. And it's counted as a subtle form of laziness. Then forgetfulness and mental wandering and depression. So one's too distracted and one's too depressed. So forgetfulness is where we are distracted, usually by external, our senses. Like everything in our senses is drawn outwards. Sounds, sights, the squirrel, the neighbours. I get distracted by words. Like I can, any loud noise, jackhammers, no problem. Nice background music. But the moment there's words, I'm there and I'm drawn into the conversation and it's all over. And I only discovered this when I was in Italy and everyone was talking Italian and it was no problem. I could concentrate. And it's because, yeah. Yeah, that's right. So there's this wonderful analogy of this. It's like our mind is like a raging elephant and it's tied by the rope of mindfulness to the pillar of the meditation. So we've got the meditation topic and we're trying to attach ourselves to the meditation topic. And so if we have the memory or mindfulness to attach our mind, in the beginning, the elephant's just raging around and around. So we can do this when we're trying to focus. We kind of feel we're in the vicinity, but we don't have a quality of focus. And then slowly, this elephant stops being a mad elephant and starts calming down and tethered to it. And then slowly, we don't have to have such incredible strength to do it. It can naturally flow. So the other thing is to choose something that to focus on that has spiritual significance and stick to it. So, of course, an image of the Buddha, which has all of the virtuous qualities there depicted, can be something incredibly beneficial. Sometimes it can be like a lotus flower, some kind of object that has a deep significance. Like you don't want to meditate on a cow or a shoe. Like if you're going to spend all this time to develop your single point of concentration and get so familiar with an object, you don't just want it to be a shoe. You want it something that's going to take you somewhere. And so then once you settle on that object of meditation, then they say to stick with it until you develop your concentration. So something like an image of the Buddha can be really beneficial because it just takes you, it's got all of the qualities of enlightenment within it as you become familiar. So we'll go into that in a little bit. Again, I'll give you an example of some of those. And so then try and practice every day so that you get the momentum, the flow of it stays there. And then try and have good conditions. So like you said, in perfect conditions, we can do it in 3 months or so. So that's if we go into full-on retreat and we're really galvanized to do it with this big view, liberation or enlightenment, then we can do it in about 3 months. It's possible. And there are Westerners that do this. There are Westerners that go into retreat and do this. And Corey will talk about those on the Tuesdays, I'm sure. But what makes us fall off the wagon or not complete it is that we don't have the ethical background to it of the reason why. Why are we doing this? We have to have a really big altruistic purpose. The other thing about dealing with forgetfulness or distraction is that really one of the things we want to have an internal object, not an external one, because we're trying to draw our attention away from the senses, which pull us outwards all the time. We're trying to draw our attention inwards. So if we're focusing on, say, a candle flame or something that we're looking at, where's our focus going? It's going back out again. And we're relying on our senses and not our mind. So even if we have, say, an image of the Buddha, that's just a memory prompt and we might look at it for a while, but then we close our eyes and we have that image in our mind. Or if we are meditating on, say, a candle flame or a lotus flower, you have the image and then you close your eyes and you have the mental image, and that's the really important thing. So you're bringing your focus inwards. And then your focus go back out again, and so then you bring it in again. Yeah, and so those Sunday meditations on Shakyamuni Buddha, I mean, they're really beneficial like that, because you get led through the meditation, you get the really good motivation to do it, those four immeasurable attitudes for caring for all living beings, wishing them to be free of suffering, wishing them to have happiness, to have equanimity. You're led through the meditation, all the details of the Buddha. So that's the analytical part. And then your mind is supposed to just settle and focus, just sit in that space without going, jumping around all the details. So you kind of build it up, all the details, and then you stay. It's called the placement meditation. You stay completely calm on that object. And then the moment you can feel your mind moving again to this or that, then you go back to looking at all the details and remembering what they represent until it becomes more of a stable experience, and then you sit with that stable experience. So that kind of leads to the next one of mental wandering and depression. So often, because we've tried to focus and we get tired, then all of that effort either produces agitation or depression. And often forced concentration produces a heaviness of mind that leads to sleep, which is a coarse form of depression. So if any of you have been to teachings on emptiness or dependent arising, I mean, it's famous within Buddhism, teachings on wisdom realizing emptiness, that's the big thing. We'll look at that next week. It's a really difficult subject. It's really difficult intellectually, and it's really difficult emotionally, because all of our afflictive emotions know their time is up. And so they just throw everything at us. All the inner saboteurs come up. And so the moment people start talking about emptiness, everybody goes to sleep in the whole room. Like, everybody just goes uncontrollably on the nod. It just happens again and again and again. And it's not because people are sleepy, but it's because you have to put so much effort into it that you just bust. It was great to read this, that it's from this forced concentration. It's just going too hard, too fast, you know, and all the obstacles come up. But even then, you can, what do they say? You can lose the battle, but you can win the war. And this happened to me one time when Lama Zopa Rinpoche, so Lama Zopa Rinpoche was teaching at Chenrezig Institute, and of course it always ends up talking on emptiness. And I was determined to stay there and concentrate, but I was delirious with sleep. And you know when people are like, they're sitting there in meditation, but they're doing this because they're falling asleep. So I was doing the whole thing like this. And I thought, I don't know what I'm going to do. So I sat on my hands because I thought I'd like go do something really stupid. And the whole night, like it was hours, like from 8 p.m. to about midnight, it was just torture for me. I was just determined to stay awake, and I couldn't. And I was hallucinating, and there were like great big bunny rabbits on the side over there. And it was just like, and I don't know what Rinpoche was saying, and I was just like, I don't care. I'm going to stay here. I'm going to try and stay awake. And I was almost crying with it, actually. And so then by about midnight, the teachings finished, because His Holiness said to Rinpoche, you're not allowed to teach past midnight because people need to go to sleep. So then about 1 minute past midnight or 1 minute to midnight, then Rinpoche's, then we dedicated. And I was so upset that I just couldn't do it. But I tell you what, after that, I've never had that happen again. And I'll sit down and the wave of sleepiness will come over me, and it'll just be like a wave. It just comes and it goes, and it doesn't get me. It was just incredible. So it was like all I had to do was just hang on there. And I don't have a fear of it anymore, and I can find that I can get underneath it. Like we were talking about beforehand, you get into a lower gear. I can get underneath that sleepiness. and just awaken my mind up a little bit more. So you can do it. It is possible. There's another form of wandering or depression that is a little bit more subtle that meditators need to be careful of, which is where we get so familiar with the object that we just kind of settle into it in a dull way. So settle into, say, looking at a view and just breathing, or settle into a nice picture of Shakyamuni, or settle into just hearing the person lead the meditation, but your mind gets a bit dull. It's not engaged and clear, and there's no real clarity in the meditation. And this can also happen if, when you're doing your own meditation, you just extend the time. So you might be meditating on the Buddha and on the image of the Buddha, and you go, oh, 5 minutes, I can do 10, I can do 20, I can do an hour, I can do 2 hours, but you're kind of there. It's a pacified state, but it's dull. And they say that's probably the most dangerous state to be in. And so for that reason, it's better to still keep your meditation sessions shorter, but just make it more and more clear, rather than extending the time out. So it's like subtle sinking, it's called. And in the beginning, it's okay because your mind is pacified, but it just means later on it's going to be really, really hard to focus. So I think the way to deal with these, especially as Westerners, and Corey Jackson will talk about this a lot more in the coming Tuesdays, is a whole process of first we have to be rested and know how to relax. So we relax our body and our mind before we start. And then we focus. And then when we fall off the wagon, we kind of notice and gently bring our attention back again. And there is a way to do that. And so setting the conducive conditions first, being comfortable, being rested, being relaxed, being confident that you know where you're going and this is the path to do, all of those things really make a huge difference. The other thing, does anyone here drive? Do you all drive cars? Yep. So have you done like long distance driving? You know, driven to Sydney or whatever? Felt sleepy when you're driving? So what happens there? How do you notice that you...
A bit starey.
You get a bit starey, that's right. So that's like the subtle sinking. You're kind of there, you're on autopilot, it's not very clear. But then something comes in and notices, isn't it? So what they have, this idea in meditation, is you have one part of you is meditating and the other part is checking. Just like with driving. So one's doing the driving and the other's checking. Oh, I'm getting a bit sleepy. Got to do something here and adjust it. So it's really similar to that, our meditation. And just like with the driving, if you get a bit starey, it's okay for a while, but yeah, disasters can happen down the track. Okay, then the next couple are much easier. When problems arise, not correcting it, so not taking a break, putting water on your face, having a little sleep and regrouping again. You do that for driving and you do that for meditating as well. Same. When we get too loose, then we kind of just tighten it up again. And like with me, you know, I had that epic battle to not fall asleep. But now I just go, just lift my focus up a bit and I can do it. And there's no fault in if you're doing a long meditation or if you're in a meditation class and you're just so tired, go out and wash your face and come back again. Like splashing water on your face is good. Or drink bottle with cold water on the back. So we've got all these different ways to correct problems. And then the other one is overapplying the antidotes. So that's when you still keep correcting things, even when things are going well. So it might be being overly critical with your progress, but it's also, if anyone's ever done an artwork or made some very elaborate cooking, if you don't know when to stop, and it's like, it's done, just stop now, don't do anything else to it. And then you go, oh, I'll just add this other thing in, and it's ruined. So, over application of the antidote. For us, what this can be is when we are analysing something or we're going through an analysis to come to a conclusion, to retrain our mind, and then we don't stay on it. We go, oh, what about this and what about that? And we continue on. Too much analysis. So let's do a little meditation, shall we? To get an example of this. And for you, I don't know your name. What's your name? Okay. So this image here of Lama Yeshe, it's really lovely. He's in the meditation posture that we can try and emulate. And I just love it because you can see how he's alert, he's relaxed, it's all there, and it's all reflected in just a physical posture. Okay, so the meditation posture, similar to how we did at the beginning of the class, straightening your spine, try and do it from this experience from the inside of the thread of light running from the base of your spine up through your body, out through your crown, just in front of your spinal column. So that you adjust the straightness of your posture, feeling from the inside. If you're on a cushion, hips higher than your knees. And if you're on a chair, your lower back well supported. Try and have your feet firmly on the ground so you have stable posture. Then hands in the lap, right palm on top of left with the thumbs lightly touching. So this has really deep significance. It's the wisdom supporting the compassion and the two truths uniting the two thumbs. The head just slightly tilted forward, chin tucked in, a slight smile on your lips. So that is like a neurological hack to help keep our mind happy. Tongue on the upper palate behind the top teeth. And the jaw relaxed. So this helps that we don't have to swallow too much in our meditation. And then eyes just slightly open, so a sliver of light comes in. So again, neurologically, this signals to our brain it's not all dark and we're not going to sleep. It's not sleep time. And then as we're settling down, so just like our body is settled down, and even though the world is going on around us, we're not getting up and following the car down the road or following the person down the road. We're just aware of those things in our periphery. So in the same way with our mind, there might be thoughts and feelings going on all the time. We can just leave them in the periphery. And what we do is we bring our focus to the breath. And what you'll notice when you're bringing your focus to the breath is that it's very easy for our attention to be captured by our senses, by a sound, our mind immediately jumps to the sound and then imagines what it is, or by a sensation, a physical sensation. So just have your focus instead on the breath, but not super tight, maybe just 80%, and 20% can be allowed to be aware of what's going on around us, but just not hopping in and getting involved. And as you're focusing on the breath, try and be aware of the entire duration of the breath, all the way of breathing in, aware of the pause, aware of breathing out, the beginning, the middle, and the end of the breath, the pause, the breathing in. So a continuous awareness of that breath. And every time the mind wanders off to either an external thing or an internal thought or feeling, just like that elephant wandering off, but still tethering our focus just to the breath, whether it's far away or close in, never losing that focus. And then, because it is late at night, after a long day, if you find your mind becoming dull or sleepy, there is a way to awaken our mind. When this happens, this kind of depression, so imagine that your mind is encased in a seed, a bright seed at the level of your heart, like the size of a pea. And then imagine that this seed of your mind shoots up through that central channel, out through the crown of your head, and into the clouds above. And above the clouds, into the spaciousness of the sky. So feel your whole awareness there in that seed, shooting up from your heart, out through your crown, and up into the spaciousness of the sky. Enjoy that spaciousness. And then gently let that seed slowly come down to rest again at the heart. And then again, noticing how your focus on the breath is lighter and clearer. I'm going to just bring this short contemplation to a close. Rejoice at your efforts and dedicate them to attaining the skills of higher concentration so that you can achieve complete liberation from the cyclic existence and even enlightenment for the benefit of all. And you can gently open your eyes if they're closed. Okay, so any questions about the meditation? So for the breathing meditation, even doing the 9-round breathing or meditating on the breath, they say about 22 minutes, something like that. And then if you're doing, say, a Shakyamuni Buddha meditation, then maybe you can add on, so at the most, say, maybe you do, say, 10 minutes of the meditation and 10 minutes of breathing and maybe 20 minutes of Shakyamuni Buddha, something like that. So between, say, 20 minutes for a beginner for the first year or so, and then maybe up to, say, 40 minutes max. So not hugely long. Of course, sometimes the meditations are longer in a group because it's easier. And of course, just like it's easier to go and practice in a gym than it is to get your trainer out at home, your bike and do whatever, or the walking machine at home, it's much easier to train in a group, meditate in a group. So some general handy hints. So we want to have physical solitude and mental solitude. So this is the conducive conditions. If we want to meditate, we want to make it easy for ourselves. So physical solitude means having a nice spot, having somewhere set up that where you see it, you go, oh, I can't wait to meditate, rather than, oh my God, I really should meditate, and then you leave the room. And try and have it completely free of social media. So don't just turn your phone off and put it down, leave your phone outside the room. Studies have been done about this one. For school kids and for meditators, leave your phone outside the room. It makes a huge difference. Pets can be a real distraction. They can be nice, but they can be a distraction. So you just got to see where you are in your practice. Writing lists of things, having lists come into your head when you're sitting there. So, of course, that happens. Finally, you've got some mental peace and clarity, and what comes in is just your normal daily practice. I've got to do that. I've got to do this. Oh, my gosh. So, me too. And not only that, when you get over those lists, then ideas come, creative ideas, my best ideas. So the middle way solution to that is have a notepad and just write it down. Just write it down, because otherwise you're like, oh my God, I've got to remember that, I've got to remember that, and you won't. So just write it down and then put it aside, and it will pass. That compulsion of lists will pass. It will. Yeah, that's right, more and more creative. So I think if you don't write it down, that's what happens. You have the space, the creativity comes up, and then all the solutions to the creativity, and on it goes. But if you go, there's that idea, you write it down, and then you go back to your object of meditation, you'll be free. And no, as in the middle of the meditation, when those things come up and distract you, just to free you of that distraction. And then if you are having all those creative ideas, you write them down, you leave them. Don't succumb to the allure of them just because they're quality. Keep doing your meditation, but at the end of the meditation, set aside an extra 5-10 minutes to write down all of those things. So you do capture them. But it's like in their right place. Yeah. And then it'll be okay. It'll work. Free of alcohol or drugs, including free of having a coffee before sitting down to meditate so you don't go to sleep. I mean, sometimes if you're desperate, okay, but, you know, really, we shouldn't We should be trying to just use our mind here. Then mental solitude, free of rumination of objects of lust or hatred. So that means so mental solitude means that even if we've got all the external conditions right, we sit down and suddenly there's all our problems again. So we have whatever we've been dealing with. And if we're not careful, we'll start going around and around and around with those as well. They will haunt us. So object problems, resentments. She said that. I should have said this. I should have said that. And off we go. All of those things. So our afflictions are really strong drivers. Or objects of lust or attachment. Things we want, things we're looking forward to, things we're anticipating, things we love, lovely memories, all of those things, and off we go. So there's a real enjoyment and allure of those things. If we want to daydream on those things, we have to make time, but it's not in the meditation session. So add on a little bit of extra time after your lovely meditation to go and get a cup of coffee or tea and sit down on the deck and look at the view and have those memories and thoughts and think those great things about your friends, but not in the meditation session. So I think it's a real balance here because we do need to be creative with our meditation practice. We are progressing and we're working on ourselves as human beings, but in the meditation, we're really trying to tame our mind. So you don't have to give up on those things, but just do it afterwards. And also, when we're going to think about those problems, or we're going to plan our holiday or whatever it is, or design the creative thing, we're going to be much better at it after the meditation. If it's a problem, we'll come up with much better solutions after the meditation because our mind will be fresh and primed. So we need to create the mental solitude in the meditation to create that space, that spaciousness, to tame our mind, meditate on objects of virtue, and then afterwards we'll experience all the benefits. All those times that we're just looking forward to, thinking, oh my God, I need a holiday. Well, actually, the real holiday is the mind free of delusion. So we can get a holiday. Sometimes the whole reason we need to have a physical holiday because it's the only time that we rest, eat well, relax. But of course, as we know, that's not enough. If we don't work on our mind, then we don't get the mental holiday free of delusion. So we can actually have a holiday in our mind through meditation, even while everything else is going on and full of pressure, we can find that freedom that we learn from, that we yearn for in meditation, even if it's a bit of hard work at first to get focused. So, I mean, I found this. We just had our Easter retreat and 3 sessions in the morning, bam, 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 and I was leading it, so I had to be totally focused. And so it was a lot of effort that went into it, but also it was so enjoyable. Like I got a huge amount out of it. And so that is the holiday, that part. The initial kick to get started, you know, with the concentration, that effort, but then there's this huge benefit. Delusions are all the afflictive states of mind, so anticipation, yearning, loneliness, resentment, agitation, all of the stuff often when we think about friends or enemies, stuff that we want, just general distraction, all of those things. Not being happy to just sit with the bare face of our innate mind. And often when we first sit down to sit, we're like in civil war inside. And I think this is like even in the COVID lockdowns, this is what was so confronting to people, that when you have to be with yourself and you can't. It's terrible. It's terrible to discover that. It's so terrifying. And so then we think, oh, the solution is something outside of ourselves. But actually the solution's never out there. It's got to be, we have to be able to be peaceful with ourselves. And so often when we first sit down to meditate, the whole crazy cacophony starts up, doesn't it, in our mind? And we've just got to let it settle down. So a mind free of delusion, attachment and aversion, confusion, those things, afflictive states of mind that cause us to be unpeaceful. So they say, you know, even meditation means repairing the mind. So it's like relax and repair the mind. Meditation is becoming familiar with the objects of virtue, and the purpose is to repair the mind. So when we want a holiday, what do we want? We just want to repair ourselves, don't we? It's the same thing. So actually, wanting a holiday is like a sublimated wish to repair our mind. Choose a virtuous object of meditation to focus on. Avoid the allure of the laxity, of the kind of getting relaxed but getting dull and then getting sleepy and then falling asleep. So there is a real allure. I know when you're about to get sleepy, there's this, oh, I'm just going to close my eyes for a moment kind of thing. There's an allure there. There's also an allure of laxity. Oh, what's that? Like anything that's shiny, I'm looking at it. And yes, the rather than lengthening the time of the meditation, keep it at a set time and just make the quality better. So if we're meditating on the Buddha or an image of the Buddha, you know, we have, we've got this incredible Buddha statue here, but also you can have an image of the Buddha at home. The whole purpose is to help draw our mind and become familiar with all of the aspects of enlightenment, what we ourselves want to achieve. So it's a highly meaningful object to focus on. And it's kind of different from, say, just having nice, smooth, you know, calming music or a beautiful view. Like those things are like a preparation to get our mind into a nice state. But in themselves, they're not enough. We've got to have something else that can take us all the way to enlightenment. So even if we are meditating on an image of the Buddha, it's actually a memory prompt. So you can get really familiar with what the Buddha looks like, but that's not who the Buddha is. Who the Buddha is an experience of enlightenment. So then we close our eyes and then we have this image, and it might just be like a fuzzy kind of gold triangle to start with. That's okay. The most important thing is to have the feeling of the Buddha there, an enlightened being that perfectly knows you, perfectly loves you, and can show you the way out of suffering, and how to connect with a being like that. So even if you're not a Buddhist, still think about, say, a being that is beyond suffering, that can lead you out of suffering, that is totally reliable, that completely loves you and cares for you, and has ultimate wisdom and compassion. So even if you just imagine that, even just like a ball of light, but you have the experience of that. The reason that we have an image of the Buddha is that there's a huge amount of meaning in a Buddha image. So for instance, the robes of the Buddha, they're three types of robes that he wears, and they represent the three higher trainings, which is what this course is about. They represent ethics, concentration, and wisdom. And so you think, what protects us in life? What's our protection? Like our protection from the weather, the storm of the world, is these three higher trainings. So you get a real experience of that. I mean, there's all sorts of other things. There's the three lines on the Buddha's neck that represent the three types of generosity. So then you can be thinking about, may I develop those kinds of generosity? So generosity of giving things, which depends on how much stuff we have to give. Generosity of giving safety and love. And generosity of giving the Dharma or education. The Buddha's hair, so it's deep blue and it's got all these curls and they're individually curled to the right, each little hair. And so that represents that, like, the Buddha's mind has no tangles. It's completely, completely wise. There's a huge amount there that we can meditate on, and it's so much nicer to have this as an experience rather than a list of dot points, isn't it? You have a real connection. So it becomes very vivid, like really personal relationship. And then you have the meditation, like the Sunday meditation, where you go through a process of transformation. So the whole point of meditating on the Buddha is that the Buddha is like a mirror. So every time you see an image of the Buddha, you're thinking, this is a mirror. This is a mirror of my enlightenment potential. This is a mirror of what I too can achieve, become enlightened. And at the moment, we're just disconnected from that. So how do we connect? We've got to connect with someone who's done it before to show it's possible. And as we connect with all those qualities and bring those qualities to the fore, then we can become a Buddha. So in the meditation, we go through this whole transformative experience of starting off from us here, the Buddha there. We're just our ordinary problematic self. The Buddha is perfect and enlightened. And then light comes from the Buddha. Usually first it's white light and it washes through us. So we get this experience of being completely cleansed. And it's not just being told, but you're imagining it. So your whole nervous system feels like it's happening. And then into that purity, then all the gold light comes, all the qualities of enlightenment, and you feel it filling you up. And then, now that you've gone through this transformation, the Buddha comes across space and melts into you, and you become the Buddha. So that trajectory is what happens in every meditation. So it's not that you, problematic self, turn into the Buddha. You go through this whole process. And then you arise as an enlightened being and you practice, you live your life as if you're a Buddha from that motivation, and it changes everything. And so even when you admire a Buddha statue and you think it's beautiful, you can just think, no, actually what I'm admiring is virtue. And the very fact that you can recognize virtue and all of those qualities means that it's resonating within you, it's part of you. So next time you look in the bathroom mirror, have a little think about it. So in summary, we've got concentration. Our concentration, as you can see, it's a lot more than just focusing on something motivated by the afflictions. It's informed by love, an altruistic higher purpose, by our ethics. It's the opposite to attention capture, which is what happens to us all day, every day, and why we're so exhausted at the end of the day as well. Dominance by our senses. And meditation on the Buddha, remember, it's the mirror of your potential. So do you have any last questions or anything? Faith, did you get your question answered, kind of? You might have to come back to some meditation sessions to get some practice in. So on Thursday nights, we actually have the mindfulness meditations to have this practice. But this is the background to it, so that we get inspired and we don't fall off the wagon. I did. I spend my time when I've got no concentration left just fiddling with the PowerPoints to make them nice. Thank you. I'm glad you noticed. That's very good. Okay, so let's dedicate the merits then. So we've done all of this. We've come along to the class, which is we've put effort in. And then we've focused. And it takes energy to do that. So you've got to, regardless of the quality of your focus or concentration, you've got to appreciate, yep, I've put my energy where it matters, made today highly meaningful. So rejoice at your efforts. Rejoice at your good-heartedness, your care and concern for yourself and for others. Recognize how that is a rare and precious thing, and then dedicate all of that effort, all of your wisdom and compassion, all of your progress along developing concentration, dedicate it to the highest possible aim, to perfectly develop your concentration so that you can actually become a Buddha for the benefit of all sentient beings. You know, be able to go along the path and eliminate all the afflictive emotions and develop all of the qualities and become a Buddha. And the way to do that is with that concentration, that skill. So dedicate everything to that for your own benefit and the benefit of all others. Thank you very much. Next week we're going, it's the last one. It's on wisdom. I hope you all don't fall asleep.